Hello, everybody. Today, you will not hear the deep voice and perfect accent of my partner, Toby Kathman, who usually runs these podcasts. You will hear a Spanish accent and this cranky voice, because today I have the pleasure and the opportunity to discuss life, discuss work, discuss lawyering, and to have a conversation with my dear partner and head of Guernica 37 International Justice Chambers and co-founder of the Guernica Group, Toby Kathman. Hello, Toby. How are you?
Hi, Almu. Lovely to speak to you.
Excellent. Are you ready for these questions and answers joke that we're going to play?
With a certain amount of trepidation, yes.
Well, actually, this is a great opportunity because as much as I think I know, and we have not talked enough over this number of years together about who, you know, how you, began this journey and how you became a barrister. I like a great deal about you, and it was a very interesting thing to me, the fact that your journey to become a barrister is not a very traditional one. I will say it's an unorthodox track. I always call it that way. And I think it will be very interesting to hear how this began and when you decided to join this noble profession.
Well, I think unorthodox is probably an understatement for how I came to be a barrister. I'm quite often asked to talk about my long journey to coming to Guernica, and quite a lot of the time I say that I fell into my career. That may be an oversimplification of how I came to be a barrister, but I think it's fair to say that the English bar is generally composed of those that have gone through a public school education, red brick university education, and then almost coming straight to the bar out of university. So for me, it was very different. I had a number of different, I would say, stabs at having a career before I settled on the law. I was a photographer first. I was involved with, actually my father wanted me to be a civil engineer, which I did for a short period of time, but I didn't have a great deal of interest in that. And I've done graphic design. Those are some of the things that I've done leading up to becoming a barrister. But I think what the changing point for me, I started working in about 95, 96, with my brother, actually. And we had this interesting time in the champagne industry, which after doing that for some time, I decided that I wanted to go to university. And I was effectively pushed by my sister-in-law, my brother's wife at the time, Tali, who I became very close to, who pushed me into university. And so initially what I was doing was a business degree with an option of law as well. So, but it was business law and the law relating to financial services, which is a far cry from what you and I do now, but it gave me my first introduction to the law. And I think one of the first debates that I became involved in university, even doing my business degree, was in relation to an advertising campaign that the company Hoover was advertising, that if you spent a certain amount of money, you would get a free holiday, but the holiday was almost impossible to acquire. So it resulted in litigation, and that was one of the first legal debates that I dealt with at university. And it really gave me this passion to learn the law. And so at the end of my first year of the business degree, I decided that I wanted to transfer and I wanted to do a single honours law degree. And I don't think I would have had the courage to do it had it not been for, I think, two people. in my life. One was Tali, my sister-in-law, and then my wife, Sandra. I mean, I think it was talking to her that really gave me the courage to make a jump.
Fascinating. And let me ask you something. The perception of people outside of the UK, you were born in the UK, it's to be a barrister versus a solicitor. It's always associated perhaps with a different amount of responsibility or duties, but also associated to elites and to a profession that has perpetuated within a fair amount of elitism. How have changed over the years, and why not a solicitor and a barrister?
Well, I think the traditional difference between a solicitor and a barrister was in court advocacy. Barristers were those that would go to court and would argue a case, and the solicitor would have, certainly in a criminal law context, much more direct contact with a lay client, and would instruct a barrister to argue the case in court, not just in court, but in written submissions, so written advocacy and oral advocacy. And that was traditionally the principal distinction between a barrister and a solicitor. You're right in the sense when you refer to the elitism of the profession, and it's certainly how it's regarded internationally as well. I mean, one of the first things that I found when I first started in an international practice was the way in which solicitors and barristers were regarded internationally was very, very different. And it was almost as though solicitors were looked upon as being on a much lower level than barristers, which of course is not true at all. The two professions are just different. You're dealing with very, very different skills and attributes, but that changed over time. And so you now see solicitors doing much more trial advocacy, and you see barristers dealing with litigation, which was traditionally the role of the solicitor. So, for example, I'm also licensed to conduct litigation, which previously you would never have that. So I think the way in which the two professions are considered has changed over time, but I think the perception, the way it's regarded internationally, is still very much the same. I think people still have very traditional views as to what a solicitor does and what a barrister does. And quite often with some of our international clients, they don't actually know what a solicitor does compared to what a barrister does. So, you know, there are difficulties explaining it.
There's something else that I believe our audience of this podcast may be of interest, and it's always been a very intriguing thing for me, is that when you think about international law, and I want to ask you more generally why international law of all the fields that you could choose, but also when you think about international human rights law and international criminal law as we know it, and there are very few and almost none countries outside of the United Kingdom that has been able to house successfully such expertise in conventional legal venues. I would like to say, with that I mean barrister chambers and even solicitors chambers or solicitors offices, that there are a number of them in the United Kingdom. In the United States, which I'm more familiar with, you would have big law firms with financial capability of doing pro bono work and engaging in this way. In most of the world, what you have is just nonprofit or public interest associations. However, in the United Kingdom, you do have these barristers' chambers. How is that? And how did that came about? And is it really an honest and even profitable practice, or there are more grays than we perhaps see from the spectator's perspective?
I think things are very different now than they've ever been before. I think if you look at the way traditionally that barristers' chambers were established and how they operated, is obviously very different than it is today. Whereas, you know, you speak about the big US law firms, of which there are many of them in London as well. Many of the major law firms have very, very strong positions within the UK market, and many of them are based in the city, dealing more with civil commercial law than anything else. But with Barristers Chambers, and it's also quite curious as to where they're placed. As you know, there is a small part of London around the Inns of Courts, in which there are a number of Barristers Chambers in very, very old, beautiful buildings, primarily, that they are all within the sort of the small area of Chancery Lane, Holborn, around the four Inns of Court. And, you know, it is still considered to be something that represents our great history. And you know, it is a tourist trap as well, where people really see this antiquated profession in that way. But I think the way that Barristers Chambers has evolved over time to compete on an international market, I would say it's primarily due to two areas of law: international criminal law, for certain, but also international commercial law and arbitration, which has caused Chambers in two very different areas to evolve into much more of an international practice. And certainly from the international criminal law side, the area in which most of our work is conducted, there is this desire for clients at the International Criminal Court, the ad hoc tribunals of Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and more recently with institutions like for Lebanon and Kosovo. There is this strong desire to have British counsel. It is almost as though the way in which the English bar is considered far exceeds any other legal practice around the world. It is considered to be, as you quite rightly said, the elitist profession, the best of the best. And so, you know, it's a matter of pride to be associated with such an honourable and well-respected profession. But I think that the way in which Chambers have had to change over time to compete on a global scale and to be able to practice internationally is something that we've seen in the last few years. And certainly it was, I would say, the driving force, and we can obviously get onto it more later, but it was the driving force that pushed me out of the chambers where I used to be at 9 Bedford Row, which was a traditional criminal set of chambers, to come together and set up Guernica, because of the fact that chambers are not set up to deal with international work. And as you said, there is this this notion that international human rights practice, for example, is conducted primarily by non-profits, NGOs, whereas chambers and chambers practice such as ours has started to compete more and more for that kind of work.
And then that brings me perhaps to the natural next question: is why international law instead of commercial law or international arbitration? Why this small niche of international accountability through criminal law, and not exclusively in international human rights law?
You know, there are a number of factors that push me into developing an international practice and heading into international law. And unfortunately, I have to make the confession that it was more through luck than planning. But there are a couple of things that happened. So I finished my law degree in 2000 at the University of Northampton, and then came to London to do my, what was at that time, the bar vocational course at BPP Law School in London. And as part of my training, one of the things I had to do was, or one of the things I was encouraged to do through my Inn of Court, was to attend a training weekend, advocacy training weekend at Cumberland Lodge, which is the Royal Lodge that was the patron of my inn, Middle Temple, was the Queen Mother at the time. And so we had this weekend advocacy training course. And on the Saturday night, after we'd been taken through a number of different exercises, I was sitting in the bar having a discussion with two senior practitioners, one who's now a Queen's Counsel and is very active in advocacy training, and another who's now a circuit judge. And exchanging war stories, the barrister at that time, who's now a judge, introduced me to her husband, who was prosecuting in one of the international tribunals. And she recommended that I get involved with international work. And I thought that was, it sounded so exciting, so far away from what I envisaged my career to be, that I thought, actually, I really do want to do this. And so I was all set to go to East Timor until my wife told me that that was not really going to happen. And my wife, being from Bosnia, made it clear that if I was going to be going to any post-war country, I would be going to her post-war country. And so I think the next incidental situation that presented itself was being on holiday in Bosnia just after I'd got married, sort of meeting my in-laws for the first time, that I realized that, you know, Bosnia was a wonderful country. And I realized it was important for my wife to spend time there, having been forced to flee when she was 16 years old. So we were trying to find a way to go and spend a bit of time there. And then I was offered a job. And I was offered a job as a human rights lawyer through one of our friends who was a human rights lawyer there at this court, the Bosnian Human Rights Chamber. Each Bosnian lawyer partnered with an international lawyer. And so I was asked to apply for a vacant post, and miraculously, I got the job.
What year was this?
This was end of 2001. So I then moved to Bosnia in early 2002 with no funding, taking a huge chance. I was, you know, I didn't come from a wealthy background. I didn't have huge financial support behind me, but I thought that this was an incredible opportunity. So I decided to do a 3-month secondment effectively with this court to gain some experience. And actually the 3 months ended up being 8 years. And as the position I had was extended and extended until the end of a 2-year period, and I was getting ready to return to the UK, and then Bosnia set up this domestic war crimes court. And I was one of the first internationals sort of pulled into that to assist in advising on setting up that court. And so then that was another opportunity that presented itself, more through luck than planning, that I then developed experience in war crimes prosecution. And so after spending the next 6-7 years there, I then decided that it was time to come home to England. And I was offered a place in Chambers, 9 Bedford Row, primarily through having worked with Joanna Corner, as we know, who's now just been appointed as the judge at the International Criminal Court. But I worked closely with Joanna in that role in prosecution for a number of years. And then she really pushed me to apply to 9 Bedford Road to join. And that's what happened. And then I returned to England.
Toby, you are regarded as one of the most important and perhaps eclectic and comprehensive international practitioners out there. How did you, which I understand is a lot of serendipity and a lot of anecdotes that make a professional and then the forte career, and I'm very much in the same situation, but how did you manage to embrace in all this experience in Bosnia and transform it in a more, as I said, perhaps eclectic and in a wider international practice now once back at the United Kingdom?
I think, first of all, the work that I did in Bosnia exposed me to incredibly high-level work right at the beginning of my career. So And, you know, there are plus and minuses to that. First of all, it's very, very difficult, or I thought it was going to be very difficult to be able to compete or to top what I'd already done in Bosnia. But I think the important thing is that it had exposed me and put me in contact with people who were heads of institutions, who were senior members of the United Nations. And so it had given me a great CV to take it forward. And when I arrived in the UK, when I started practicing in chambers, so initially I was dealing with extradition matters primarily. And then I think something happened that really changed my career, and that was Bangladesh. And I'd not really been actively looking to work on any international case. I'd started working at that point with Stephen Kay, QC, who's now head of 9 Bedford Row. I was working with him on a case at the ICC in relation to President Uhuru Kenyatta. And then Bangladesh presented itself. And I would say that the Bangladesh case really changed the course of my career for the better. That's not to say that it was not without its own challenges, but many years later, after I'd finished working on that, and I ended up working on the case for 9 or 10 years, but I actually asked the client at one point, why did they choose me? Because it had such an impact on my career, and I was incredibly grateful for the opportunity to work on the case, but why did they choose me? And I was half expecting them to tell me that, you know, they had researched young members of the bar that had experience in this area of law. And actually what they said was that they did a Google search and my name alphabetically was the first one that came up. So it wasn't quite the answer I was looking for, but at least it was an honest answer. But regardless, I was fortunate to be thrown into a case that was going to, I think, change the way we deal with cases of this kind. And the reason I say that is that I flew out to Bangladesh with Stephen Kay in end of 2010 and met the clients and met the local lawyers that we were working with. And I had no idea what this case was going to be like. And for me to fly to Bangladesh, that in itself, for those that know me and actually knew me at the time, was quite something, because I had never flown out of Europe intentionally, because I was terrified, and I still am, terrified of flying. And so for me to fly at the time, to fly from London to Dubai and Dubai to Dhaka was quite something. But having said that, it was an incredible case to be working on. These were cases from the 1971 War of Liberation. This was a religious group of leaders who were put on trial for effectively opposing independence in 1971 and being allegedly collaborating with the Pakistani army to commit war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. But what was clear to me was that as meritorious as it might be for setting up a judicial institution 40 years after a conflict, this was not a legal process that was going to be based on the rule of law. This was a process that was set up by a vindictive political leader to remove political opponents. And the trials were a sham, a complete sham. And I made that quite clear publicly. And as a result of that, on my fifth visit, almost my sixth visit to Bangladesh in August 2011, actually the 5th of August 2011, a day that I'll never forget, because I'd said to my wife, who I'd left on holiday the day before, I joked with her and as I was leaving and said, look, one of these days they're going to arrest me. Unfortunately, I had to phone up my wife from the airport to say, yes, I'm just about to be arrested. And I was held for about 10 hours at the airport. And then deported with the very stark warning, do not ever attempt to come back. And that was just because I was acting for the political opposition and I was public in my criticisms of a judicial process that was based on fraud. And I think what it created was the reliance on the media and on an effective communication strategy to bring about a desired result in an international case where you are confronted with a judicial system that is effectively corrupt to the core. So, and that, I think it changed the way that I looked at cases after that. And a lot of the work that I've done since then has been using the media, using communications, using lobbying to affect a just result in an international matter.
And Toby, then the question perhaps, so the obliged question is, and when did the Guernica idea came about and why that jump from such a perhaps safe structured or safe platform into a fairly experimental one?
Well, I think my wife would probably be the first person to say that I very rarely do what's safe. And I tend to get itchy feet and bored if things are not exciting. And I've you know, made a big jump two or three times in my life to try and I suppose bring a little bit more excitement to my daily existence. So, but I think what happened was the work that I was doing at that time, and for some time I'd realized that the chambers system, and particularly the traditional chambers system, is not set up to deal with international cases. And then I think I'm not alone in thinking that. I mean, many barristers that I've spoken to that have an international practice, many of them will have the same criticisms that the chamber system is just not set up to deal with managing a practice like this. And so I had at that time already started to think about my future. I was doing quite a lot of work at that time with Cherie Blair in her firm Omnia Strategy, and Cherie had set up what was, you know, I guess one of the first hybrid institutions, which was not a chambers, not a law firm. It was a mixture of the two, which they were just starting to emerge, I think, at the time that Cherie had this idea to set that up. And so I was doing a lot of work with them and also doing the work in chambers, but also doing some of the lobbying communications work. And then I happened to meet someone who changed everything, I think. And that was you, I guess. So I think at that time I was working on a Syrian case and you were also working on a Syrian case. And one of our mutual contacts suggested that we speak. And so I remember that we didn't necessarily hit it off immediately. And I think we were both protective of our own positions. But I think once we realized that there was so much in common, and I think we had a shared vision on how to do things, I think we became closer and closer until I think we both admitted to ourselves as well as to each other that we were not happy where we were and we wanted to do something different. And I think it was when you invited me to San Francisco when you were still at the Center for Justice and Accountability, when I was asked to present the award to Navid Pillay. I think that was sort of one of the first times, or that was the defining point for me, that I really wanted to work with you and build something with you, because I thought we had that shared vision. And that was when I guess the idea really, really started for Guernica.
And for sorry that I interrupted, but which I do often, so I think that the people should see us in a in the real mood.
Absolutely.
So for our unorthodox audience that I think this podcast has, and I know that they're from many fields. And what is Guernica? Can you explain Guernica? I don't think I've ever heard you explaining Guernica. I get to explain it every other time, but I haven't heard you explaining Guernica.
Well, look, I think Guernica is, I think, as we always describe it, it is an innovative approach to justice. It's taking the best components of what is a barrister's chambers and what is a nonprofit and fusing them together to effectively address inequality, to address accountability, and to address justice. And I think for me, what Guernica represents and why I'm so proud to have started this with you is that it fuses what is the traditional barrister's chambers with an international practice that is ordinarily limited to non-profit human rights NGOs. And I think it's probably the only chambers that is dedicated exclusively to international work. And it is certainly the only chambers that I'm aware of that has a non-profit side closely connected to it. And I think what that gives us is an opportunity to do traditional legal work, but also to focus on development work in post-conflict situations. And one of the things that struck me when I was in a traditional set of chambers is that the work that I really, really wanted to do, I couldn't do because it was all pro bono. And it was very, very difficult as being a barrister relatively early on in practice to have an exclusively pro bono or non-profit practice. I appreciate that many of my colleagues who are criminal barristers generally regard having a criminal practice in England and Wales right now is pretty much the same non-profit pro bono work because of the legal aid situation. But I think the work that really interested me, in which I felt as though I could make a difference, was not work that I was ever going to get paid to do. And so you have to have a source of income, or you have to be incredibly wealthy, which I am not, and I was not. You have to have a financial base in order to be able to do that kind of work and in order to make a difference. And so by fusing the profit with the non-profit, you can actually do that, and you can actually do work that you feel really proud of doing. And so, you know, the work that we've done in Colombia, the work that we've done for Syria, for Libya, in all of these conflict and post-conflict situations is incredibly important, but we wouldn't have the opportunity to do that if we were not set up in this way. And the other thing which I think is particularly important about Guernica, whether we look at the chambers or the center, is in its membership. The people that form Guernica is what I think makes Guernica so impressive. And, you know, I think you and I are very, very fortunate in that the people that we are surrounded by and who we work with on a daily basis, whether they are an intern with us for 3 months or some of our younger lawyers who have been with us for years, to the senior lawyers who help guide us and give us advice and support. I mean, these are the very best at what they do. They are hugely dedicated to what they do, and they all share that same passion for truth, justice, and accountability. And I think that's what makes it so important, and that's what makes it such an innovative way of working. I can honestly say that I wake up every day knowing that what I have to do today is not going to be the same as what I did yesterday. And every day presents new challenges. And I think that's what gives me the excitement and the drive to continue, is that we work on so many different situations and we have the support to do that. And as a barrister, you don't have that support. You don't have that expertise. You know, I don't know enough when I start on a situation about the history and the politics of Venezuela. But we have people who do. And that's why I think it's such a good way to work on cases like that. But we also have those that have a completely independent practice as a barrister as well. So I think we have the best of both worlds.
I agree. I like to think that we have a formula that guarantees that we can also hold ourselves accountable to the work and never lose sight of what really matters at the end, you know, maybe talking about victims as being even to reductions, but it is really that you need to impact countries and empower people to be able to change some of the situations that we face. And I do believe that this formula, but obviously, for those who, you know, who sometimes wonder, is a formula that guarantees, well, that the expertise, the knowledge, and the technical ability to make the changes that are necessary.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, one of the interesting questions that quite frequently comes up. So, I mean, I was asked this when I was working on Bangladesh, and I've recently been asked that in relation to the work that we do at the Kosovo Specialist Chambers as well. So the quite often the question is asked, well, you know, if you're striving to represent victims, and this is all about victim representation and improving a system of justice, how can you then represent individuals who are accused of crimes? And the way that I always answer that is particularly with reference to the English legal system, and that our English legal system and our judicial system is so strong because of the independence of the profession, the professionalism of barristers, whether prosecuting or defending. And I think in order to serve the interests of justice, there has to be a rigorous prosecution and defense. Otherwise, that system really serves no purpose. And that was why I got involved with the Bangladesh International Crimes Tribunal, was to really test the system and to ensure that only those persons for which the evidence demonstrated were guilty would be convicted, and convicted according to the evidence. Unfortunately, it was an entirely loaded system, and so we were never going to succeed. But I think you have to have strong advocates to ensure that the system is the system represents justice, and it follows the rule of law. Otherwise, as I say, it serves no purpose whatsoever.
Toby, when we conceived this podcast, we call it the Accountability Podcast. And we have gathered, lucky us, including you, some of the most interesting voices in the field of justice and accountability around the world to come and to allow and graciously being interviewed, which we have no business in being interviewers, as everybody can see now from me, and said very interesting things. So I'm glad that I have the opportunity now to ask you the question that we ask everybody, which is, what does accountability mean to you? And how, and it's funny, you know, to talk about these in this pandemic, and one of the deepest moments of this pandemic, and as the world has changed dramatically, and as today, as that day, the Tory party in the United Kingdom got all the overwhelming vote for Brexit. So everything is changing fast and not necessarily to a better place. So what do you think accountability is, and how can we improve it, secure it in the current set of events?
Well, look, it's a really interesting question, and I can answer it by reflecting on some of the answers that I've been given in the previous podcast before I give my view. And I think one of the most interesting answers that I received to that question was from a Syrian documentary maker, producer, Wad al-Khatib, who made this incredible film for Sama about the attacks on the Al-Quds Hospital in Aleppo in 2016. And so What was particularly interesting for me when I asked that question was her answer was, it's something that they've never experienced in their lifetime. And so I think you have to look at what accountability means to the audience that you're serving. For Wired, it meant being able to hold individuals accountable for the crimes that they had committed for years, for decades in Syria, and to produce or to establish a system that they've never seen before. They'd never seen a system based on the rule of law. They'd never seen a system based on justice. And so how can we serve them? Well, we can serve them by giving them a voice. And I think first and foremost, accountability to me means giving those persons who have been targeted, whether it is through conflict, whether it is through the abduction, disappearance, torture of family members, whether it is the destruction of their homes and their communities, it is giving them a voice and giving them access to justice, giving them a route to, or I would say a forum in which those complaints can be heard and that their voice can be heard and not silenced. I was interested to read this week about the Saudi activist, Lujan, who she had been pushing for women's rights. And she was effectively thrown in jail for advocating for women's rights, which is unbelievable. And so she was convicted for effectively communicating with international organizations, for speaking to the United Nations, and for calling for women to have the same rights as men. And she was effectively sentenced to 6 years in prison. She may be released within the next 2 or 3 months, but she will not be able to leave her country. There's a ban on her leaving her country for 5 years. And if she breaches the terms of her release, she will be thrown back in jail. And so that is censoring her voice, that is removing her voice, that she will not be able to safely advocate for the rights of women. Accountability to me means holding those people responsible who have removed those rights. And I think that at its core is what it means to me.
And my last question, and maybe perhaps the most personal, I know for, you know, how thankful I am that we came together and that we put together this experiment is now 4 years old, and we have, like you say, an extraordinary team that makes our days easier and our project real every day. So whom are you thankful to, and who would you like, you know, you think that is really the cause of you being here and now and doing all of this?
Well, look, I think the list is long of the people that I'm very thankful to. One of the things that I've said recently, you know, we've received at Guernica hundreds of requests for advice to people on how to succeed in an international practice, how to build an international practice, how to have the strength and the courage to make such decisions, to pursue a career such as this. And the way that I've always said this or answered this is that I would not be where I am now had it not been for the opportunities that I've been given by a number of people. And, you know, there are, I think, a number of people that have enabled me to succeed in what I do. I mean, first and foremost, there was the support that I had from my sister-in-law, Tali, and from her father as well, who sadly passed away. To give me the support and the financial backing in order to study law, and so I'm incredibly grateful for that. I'm incredibly grateful for the support that my wife gives to me on a daily basis, and and the encouragement my two daughters give to me every day. I'm incredibly grateful for that. I'm always thankful to Joanna Corner for what she has given me and the support that she has given me. And I know that I would not have even started my career had it not been for the time that I spent with her in Bosnia, working very closely, and the guidance that she gave me and continues to give me. And so I'm so pleased that she is now been appointed as a judge at the International Criminal Court, and I think she will do a fantastic job. And so, you know, I'm grateful to her as well. And then, you know, sort of more closer to home or at Guernica, I think the two most important people for me who I speak to every single day is you and Carl. You know, I think without the two of you, I would not be able to do what we have to do every day. And I hope that I give you encouragement in the same way that you give me encouragement and have given me the passion I think what you've given me is the passion that had started to evaporate before we started this. And I think that was really the fear that I had that I was losing interest and losing passion. So I think I'm thankful for you for that. And Carl is somebody who I've known since university. Carl was one of the first people I met at university and somebody who I've worked with closely ever since. And I think the only time that Carl and I didn't work together or study together was the years I was in Bosnia. But when I came back, we worked very closely together. But I think, as you've said, and to repeat it, every single member at Guernica, every single person that we work with, I'm incredibly grateful to, because you and I would not be able to do the incredible work we do to the exceptionally high level if it was not for each and every person who forms Guernica, because Guernica is a family.
That is true. Well, Toby, as we come to an end of this delightful interview, I must ask, and I think everybody expects me to, two very important questions. And, you know, we lawyers usually become lawyers having followed some people that we emulate or some people that we admire. And at the same time, we spend hours and hours and hours drafting and reading. And I wanted to ask you, as I think we all do, I will confess, just to break the ice, I will confess that when I draft, if I'm drafting in English, I will always almost unquestionably be listening to the Smiths. And when I'm drafting in Spanish, I will almost always will be listening to Joaquin Sabina. So my question to you is, when you draft and when you have those long days just to read or edit, what music do you listen?
I have a series of songs that I listen to whenever I'm writing, whenever I'm by myself, a playlist of songs on my phone. And it's invariably a mixture of Rolling Stones, Otis Redding, The Beatles. But I think that there are two particular songs by The Stones that I listen to obsessively. And Sympathy for the Devil. I think those are the two Stones songs that I listen to. I also listen a lot to Van Morrison. Van Morrison is one of my particular favorites. I don't know if there's any particular song that I listen to. Maybe I think it's called Goodbye Baby Blue or something like that. I listen to that one quite a lot. But I think the song that takes me back to my childhood that I still listen to constantly would be Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. That's one that I listen to a lot.
And then the second question, perhaps even more important, is I think I decided to be a lawyer when I was about 4 years old. And there's always been two movies that brought to me the desire, and they always remain dear in my heart. One was Adam's Rib with Katharine Hepburn, since then became my absolute female heroine and someone that I almost feel like I know, and I spend time with her, of how close that is to me, that character anyway. And the second one was Witness for the Prosecution. What are the characters, the fictional characters they had that being, you know, meaningful to you, and perhaps even those responsible for you to choose this line of work?
Well, unlike you and unlike a lot of lawyers, I did not obsessively strive to become a lawyer when I was young. I was always interested in the law, but I was interested in the law in a very different way. So I was quite obsessive about organized crime. That was what I read a lot about. Those are the movies that I watched, and so. But I think the character that compelled me to wanting to do what I do. I mean, there, as far as I'm concerned, there is only one fictional legal character worth talking about, and that's Horace Rumpole. No other character is worth talking about. Every summer, I go on holiday with my family to Croatia, and we have this little bar where I will sit and have a coffee and a glass of rakia, and I will read a book, and they laugh at me because I read the same book every year. And it is basically Horace Rumpole. And I read a combination of different stories of Horace Rumpole, but mostly the Penge Bungalow murders. I mean, that's Horace Rumpole is what I read every summer. I don't sort of want to see myself immortalized as a fat, aging, bald man who smokes cigars, but I think it is the passion for the law, the passion for fighting for your client, whoever your client might be. I think that's what Horace Rumpole represents, and I think that's what any true barrister represents.
Thank you very much, sir, for sharing your story. I think it was time for everybody to hear it. And it is my private pleasure to explore some of the Spanish passion into an English barrister. So for that, thank you very much, Mr. Cadman.
And thank you for dragging it out of me.
The Guernica Accountability Podcast is about accountability in different parts of the world and what it means for each of us. This is a subject that we at Guernica are very passionate about. We hope that you walk away from this today with a better understanding of the notion of accountability. If you enjoyed this podcast, as we hope you do, please do follow the series on our website and feel free to post on social media with any comments you may have. You can find our website at www.guernica37.com, where you can find more details about what we do and find all of the podcasts in our series. You can find us also on Twitter at @GuernicaLaw37, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. We hope to continue to bring you interesting accounts from around the world. In the next episode, we will be looking at a different approach to accountability, but I won't spoil the surprise now. Thanks for listening. This is the Guernica Accountability Podcast. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.